case number 09-3094, United States of America versus Byron Lamont McDade, also known as Barry, appellant. Mr. Becker for appellant, Mr. Petkin for appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Rogers, members of the panel. My name is Robert Becker, and I represent appellant Byron McDade. This court has remained an outlier at least since 1999, the only federal circuit that has refused to decide whether equitable tolling can be applied to 2255. I would suggest to you that this case, if any, is a vehicle for you to reach a decision on that issue. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it unless you have questions, but Mr. McDade did everything in his power to see that this issue would be presented in his timely petition. He notified counsel 4.5 months before the deadline. He repeatedly raised the issue in letters. On November 7th, 2004, he indicated that he was keenly aware of the deadline. And it's only due to the malfeasance of counsel that it was not included in that petition. So under those circumstances, I believe the court has to conclude that Mr. McDade not only is not at fault, because generally defendants are charged with the actions of their counsel, but counsel, in fact, thwarted his desires and stood in the way of him presenting this timely.
Assuming you're right on that, then we get to the meat of the ineffective assistance claim. And on that, how exactly would the trial have differed if it had gone the way you think it should have gone?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, I think we have to step back first before we get to how the trial would have differed, because the Strickland requires you to assess the reasonableness of counsel's decision, not in light of the whole trial. It requires you to assess the whole trial in terms of prejudice.
I'm even assuming that it was, just for the purpose of this question, just assuming that the counsel should have done a few things differently, as you say, how then does the trial itself come out differently? How does it transpire differently?
Well, we have three witnesses, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's keep in mind that this case was not an overwhelming case against Mr. McDade. It is an overwhelming case that there was a large drug conspiracy, but there are really only two witnesses who were very damaging to Mr. McDade, and two other witnesses who were far less damaging but did have testimony about him. But as to the two most damaging witnesses, Phyllis Webster and Mr. Minder, they were the critical witnesses. Two of the witnesses that Mr. Nathans did not interview were Douglas and Flowers, who had evidence that Minder, A, said he really didn't know Mr. McDade. And here we have to say, okay, what was the relationship? The fact that the two of them, Mr. McDade and Mr. Minder, were acquainted with each other, that they knew who each other were, that they could say hello to each other, doesn't indicate that Minder would have ever trusted Mr. McDade to become involved in a drug deal with him.
Could I just ask you, Minder testified he bought drugs from McDade, isn't that correct?
Well, he testified that he received drugs from Mr. McDade. Okay, and so he is very damaging in that sense. And these two witnesses would have said that Minder said, "I don't know this guy," and further corroborating Mr. McDade's contention that they were acquainted but didn't really were not intimates, Flowers would have said what Minder said was, I didn't know him this way, that way, okay, meaning as a drug dealer. So that tends to negate Minder's claims in light of the fact that he is sitting there having made a plea agreement to get, in an attempt to get out of a, what was essentially a life sentence.
A couple things on that. This is a conversation, those are conversations that occurred in prison, correct?
They were, that prompt occurred at the jail, yes.
Yeah. And then secondly, if Douglas and Flowers testify, all their activities become part of the calculus as well, right? Their gun and drug convictions. And
in fact, I did a search in ECF and court view at the Superior Court, and at the time, each one of them had one or two cases, but they did not have lengthy criminal records in this jurisdiction. I didn't go further. So the question, it's questionable whether their current cases might have been used to impeach them, but whether there was anything beyond that, I don't know. I know that that Douglas had just been sentenced on 840, on an 841 count, and Flowers had been sentenced on a 922G count in this court. But that was the only, those were the only convictions.
If you bring them in, it's connecting the defendant in some ways to the two of them, whereas the whole theory of the defense, I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, was I'm just working out at Waste Management and I'm not involved at all in this, in drug issues.
I think you are, at the way the trial judge did and the way Mr. Nathans did, assume that Mr. McDade knew these people before he was incarcerated in this case, mm-hmm. not that he met them at the jail for the first time. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't avoid meeting people who had criminal cases once he was in the jail. So whether that would be damaging to him in any way, and certainly given what I found in court view, not something compared to the records of the cooperators, and the admissions of the cooperators, these guys were far less of a problem than the people testifying against Mr. McDade. There's the other assumption that the defense counsel and
apart from that, it's just their credibility is, and there's lots of issues, right? Whether Minder would be telling the truth in prison about someone he's cooperating against.
Once again, we're assuming that they instituted the conversation about why he was here rather than him.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know that because counsel never talked to them. Mm-hmm. So what counsel didn't know was the cause of the prejudice in this case. And if you look at cases like Wiggins v. Smith, Rompilla v. Baird, there was a case in 2010, a Sears case. It's not cited in my brief. It was at 130 Supreme Court 3259. In all of those cases, what the court said is the problem is the assumption that by the trial court that the strategy that defense counsel enunciated post hoc after the trial was over was a reasonable strategy when he didn't even know what he would have gotten from the evidence he didn't go looking for. So, and what the trial judge said in this case.
But the strategy, just to pick a little bit at that, that wasn't the strategy from the evidence discussed thoroughly between counsel and the defendant on, we're just going to try to undermine the credibility of each of the witnesses against you, we're putting on no affirmative witnesses ourselves and create the impression, the defendant's theory of the case, that I was just being fingered by these people as a fall guy.
And that is certainly Mr. Nathan's rationale, but and that's what he said, but you know, whether Mr.
We don't know.
With Mr. McDade, 3 days before the trial, said there are these two witnesses out there who would testify that Minder doesn't know me and didn't do drugs with me, did drug deals with me. So, you know, that was counsel's strategy. And at least under the findings made by the trial judge, at some point during the trial, if not before, Mr. McDade decided he wanted to call Robinson. So, yeah, there was
Robinson's a different issue because of the Fifth Amendment issue, right?
Right, that's true. But There are two different issues about Robinson, one of which is, one of the things the Supreme Court said in Sears is, once the trial judge in that case found that the counsel had acted unreasonably in failing to interview failing to investigate or interview a witness, then that cast doubt on the reasonableness of the strategy. Okay? And so at that point, you get to the question of, was the strategy reasonable once the trial court found that Robinson, it was unreasonable for counsel not to interview Robinson. Now, as for the Fifth Amendment issue, there are a number of things that counsel could have learned by interviewing Robinson, which is he might have decided that he couldn't call Robinson, and that's fine. He might have decided that based on what Robinson had to say, he could have argued for the judge to at least ask the prosecutor to provide immunity to Robinson. He could have argued that some of the questions the government would have wanted to ask should not have been allowed in cross-examination because it was essential that Robinson testify. Or he could have learned that information that would have allowed him to argue that some portions of Webster's testimony should have been excluded if Robinson wasn't going to be able to testify. And he could have learned information that he could have used in cross-examination of Minder and Webster even if Robinson didn't testify. So there are many things he could have learned from Robinson. And the same applies to the other two witnesses, Flowers and Douglas, that he could have learned things that would have helped him even if they didn't testify. But coming back to the issue of the reasonableness, the judge uses two different standards for reasonableness. Once he finds Robinson, failure to interview Robinson was unreasonable, but the same issues go to Douglas and Flowers. And as for the question you raised, Judge Kavanaugh, about the strategy to not call any witnesses, on the last day of trial, just before everybody rested, Mr. Nathans indicated that he might call one witness the following day. He did not call a witness, and he never indicated that Mr. McDade would testify. And given the circumstances of Mr. McDade's having left the area, it would have been impossible for Mr. McDade to testify. So at the end of the trial, it appears the counsel may have been considering calling a witness, even though at the post-trial hearing, he later said his strategy was to not call any witnesses, which is, again, comes back to how much do you're not supposed to second-guess, and through hindsight, trial counsel's strategy. But at the same time, you're not supposed to take it on face value that it was reasonable without some question about whether he would have gained something from from having done the minimal acts of interviewing the witnesses that were available to him.
So on the record, do we know that Robinson was willing to testify to anything more than that he had not introduced McDade to Watkins?
That's what's on the record, Your Honor. But again, it comes down to the question of would he have testified? Would he have provided information that would have been helpful? In addition, beyond testifying, would he have provided information that would have changed the evidence that came in against Mr. McDade, like excluding some of Webster's testimony?
All right, so part of the government's response is look at all the things defense counsel did, how conscientious he was, and how experienced he is in matters of defense in criminal trials. So the question arises, if a defense attorney is very conscientious and has this strategy and decides when his client says a couple of days before trial, I've got two more witnesses, and the attorney evaluates what the client tells him the witnesses would say, and for some of the reasons that were indicated in Judge Kavanaugh's questions, decides not to interview them. Is that a problem under the first prong of Strickland?
I think it is, and I think the Sears case and Rompilla and Wiggins make that clear. What the judge said at the outset was, or in the order denying the motion, once Mr. McDade had decided to go to trial, the strategy, meaning the one Mr. Nathans enunciated, was reasonable in the context of the trial record as a whole.
And okay, that's so we have the district court judge here finding no problem, having presided at the trial, the district court finds no problem under the first prong of Strickland as to Flowers and Douglas.
That's correct.
So you're saying that that was error?
Yes, that was error because...
So there is no leeway. I just need to understand, there is no leeway for defense counsel. If the defendant says, I've got 100 witnesses I want you to interview, and defense counsel says, well, tell me what they would say, and defense counsel says, in my hypothetical, well, sounds like there are 20 I ought to interview, but the other 80 sound ridiculous.
And I think in that situation, you know, we could talk about, you know, unless there was evidence of what those people would say, we could talk about whether they were repetitive or things like that, whether having one witness would supplant three others because of the evidence he could provide. But this is a case of one of three people.
Okay, but let me just be clear. So if the jury had known, for example, that your client did not know
Mr. Minor?
Yeah, in the sense of presumably it would have been fleshed out that he didn't know him as someone to whom he would have provided drugs, illegal drugs. Then you still have the testimony of Watkins.
Of Webster.
Excuse me, Webster. And then you have the, even if Mr. Robinson says he didn't introduce your client to Webster, that only cuts out a part of Webster's testimony.
Well, it cuts, I guess the question is, yeah. would Mr. McDade, without some kind of introduction, the government's reason for introducing this stuff that went back before the conspiracy. I mean, they thought that evidence was very important, that how Webster and Mr. McDade came to know each other. They really thought that was important information because they understood that in order for somebody to rise within, you don't just suddenly walk up to a major drug dealer and say, I want to be part of your operation, and then get to be a lieutenant. So that takes apart some of the government's theory of how Mr. McDade got to the point where he's handling large amounts of drugs, large amounts of money, and Ms. Webster trusted him so. So, you know, any chipping away at that, and taking away how did he get introduced into this whole thing is an important part of the defense, just as it's an important part of the prosecution. So, you know, I think that is a significant piece of evidence, and I think the trial court minimized that. My time is up.
There was some, just to be clear, there was some wiretap evidence as well connecting McDade to this conspiracy, correct?
There were phone calls between Ms. Webster and Mr. McDade. There were no recorded conversations that included incriminating conversations because Ms. Webster claimed that on the day that she called Mr. McDade to straighten out the accounts for Singleton, the guy in Florida, that she did that from a payphone, not from her own phone. And so there were communications. There is evidence of calls, but there was no evidence of incriminating conversations between the two of them that was introduced at the trial.
Okay.
All right. We'll hear from the government. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, James Petkin for the United States. With respect to timeliness, I'll briefly mention that the government addressed timeliness in our brief But the district court essentially ruled on the merits and implicitly found that equitable tolling applied. The government does not waive its argument that tolling doesn't apply, and that appellant's claim remains time-barred. But because appellant's claim is so lacking on the merits, the government would ask for the court to address the merits today and to affirm the judgment of the district court.
I think your timing argument's also fairly weak. I'll just comment on that.
I think that I would disagree. I'm not sure if the court wants to hear much from me today on it.
We should probably just move to the merits, but I don't think it's this equitable tolling. I didn't think if there's a case for equitable tolling, the facts here seem pretty strong.
Understood. I mean, I would say that is this an extraordinary circumstance that's so rare and unique where the attorney, it's not appellant's attempts at getting it done are not the issue. We concede that he was diligent. Was this such an extraordinary circumstance? And we would argue that this case is much more like the Lawrence decision before the Supreme Court in 2007, where the Supreme Court basically says that mere negligence, failing to file on time, that doesn't warrant equitable tolling. And we think this is more like that case than a case like the Second Circuit case, Baldiaki, or the Fifth Circuit case, I think it's Wynn, where there's attorney deception or something that rises to such a significant level that it would warrant tolling. I think this case is more like Lawrence.
Why don't we talk about the merits?
That's fine, Your Honor. With respect to the merits, the government believes that the district court was correct in ruling that there was no deficient performance by Mr. Nathans for strategically choosing to not investigate or call Mr. Douglas or Mr. Flowers. The government believes that the district court erred in its ruling that Mr. Nathans was objectively deficient in not interviewing or investigating Mr. Robinson. With respect to Mr. Douglas and Mr. Flowers, I think the district court got it exactly right. There were numerous factors, all enumerated by Judge Friedman in his ruling, indicating the significant reasons why it was a reasonable trial strategy to not investigate Mr. Douglas or Mr. Flowers. First and foremost, the fact that witnesses were approaching somebody in protective custody could easily be explained to the jury. It was clear that Mr. Minder, it makes perfect sense that somebody in that circumstance would not admit or not fess up to knowing the appellant in this case. Also, Mr. Nathans testified, and the district court found, as a factual matter, that he already knew, and he had evidence that Minder knew appellant in this case. There were lots of areas to impeach Mr. Minder with. In fact, Mr. Biddle, on cross-examination, did hit Mr. Minder in lots of ways to significantly impeach his credibility. And the bottom line is that Douglas's testimony would have been just and Flowers too would have been a minor impeachment value, and again it also, as I think Judge Kavanaugh you alluded to, it went significantly against the appellant's strategy in this case, which was to paint Mr. McDade as a peaceful, hardworking man, a family man who didn't associate with drug dealers, people with gun convictions, people who were in the prison system. The fact that, and just for the record, it's extra record to talk about going on court view. That wasn't part of the record as to what the convictions were. Mr. Nathans testified that he was aware that Douglas and Flowers had gun convictions. However, it's clear even today, but they still were out of state.
True.
I don't know because it's not part of the record, but appellant's counsel has conceded that there were out-of-state convictions. Those would still be impeachable. With respect to Mr. Robinson, the government disagrees that Mr. Nathans was deficient in not investigating. Mr. Nathans testified about a variety of things he knew about Kent Robinson. Specifically, he knew that Mr. Robinson and appellant had a gun case together in Maryland. He knew that the government had photographs depicting appellant and Mr. Robinson apparently doing some kind of drug activity. He knew that based on the discovery he had reviewed and his conversations with the prosecutor, that the government had a significant body of information, damaging information on Kent Robinson, so damaging, in fact, that the government had approached appellant's counsel about having appellant testify against Mr. Robinson. In fact, Mr. Nathans said he thought the government was salivating to get to Kent Robinson. And perhaps most importantly, it was appellant's own decision to not interview Kent Robinson that led Mr. Nathans to not interview him. Appellant was clear. He did not want to call Kent Robinson as a witness. The district court credited Mr. Nathans' notes on that score. The district court, of course, did not make a factual finding as to whether or not appellant tapped Mr. Nathans on the shoulder mid-trial, but the government thinks that, well, actually I should go back and just say that Nathans testified and made clear at the hearing on this that he thought it would have been crazy, in his professional opinion, crazy to call Kent Robinson. the government points the court to the Strickland, the quote in Strickland on page 690 to 691, I think it's relevant here, which is that when a defendant has given counsel reason to believe that pursuing certain investigations would be fruitless or even harmful, counsel's failure to pursue those investigations may not be later challenged as unreasonable. And that's exactly this case, where the reason that Mr. Nathans didn't go after and didn't investigate Mr. Robinson was because appellant had told him he didn't want to call him. And Mr. Nathans, in his professional judgment, agreed and thought it would be crazy to call him. I think this is like the situation in the Cooley case, which is cited in DeBongo, which the government relies on in its brief in the prejudice prong. But this Cooley case is quite relevant. It's an Eighth Circuit case where the Eighth Circuit ruled that there was no deficient performance where the lawyer was told, the lawyer didn't investigate two witnesses, one who the defendant had told the lawyer was not helpful as to alibi, and the second who the defendant told the lawyer that the witness would actually hurt the case. In this case, Mr. Nathans made clear he thought Robinson would hurt the case. And for these reasons, we think the district court erred in finding that there was any deficient performance whatsoever.
And so what's your best understanding of the district's reasoning in that regard?
Well, Judge Friedman's opinion, he credits, I think the way that I read it, he credits Mr. Nathans' testimony that on January 14th of 2002, appellant said, I don't want to call Kent Robinson. Mm-hmm. However, Judge Friedman then says, without any corroboration from Mr. Nathans' notes during trial about the shoulder tapping, there's no way to make a decision. Therefore, we look to Kent Robinson's reasoning, and based on his reasoning, the government disagrees with that conclusion. Even if the court assumed arguendo or finds that there was deficient performance, which the government does not think that there was, it's clear that on this record there was absolutely no reasonable probability that the jury's decision would have been different but for Mr. Nathans' decision not to interview Flowers, Douglas, or Robinson. First and foremost, Judge Friedman's factual finding was not clearly erroneous as to his decision when he ruled, after weighing the testimony from Kent Robinson, that Robinson only would have testified and only would have added the fact that appellant did not meet Webster through Robinson. And that's assuming, of course, that Mr. Robinson would have been permitted to testify selectively, which Judge Friedman found was dubious at best. But Judge Friedman's ruling is based on a assumption that Mr. Robinson would have been able to testify, and it's Mr. Robinson's own words on page 108 in the transcript from the hearing, where on cross-examination he tells Ms. Berthrong from our office, he says that he would absolutely only answer the question of, did appellant meet Webster through him? That's the only thing he would have testified to. He would have pled the fifth on everything else. And Judge Friedman takes that and makes that factual finding. And therefore, he finds, and the government thinks quite astutely, that that small piece would have only slightly tarnished Webster's testimony, especially given that the jury already had evidence that Webster and McDade knew each other. In fact, Kent Robinson's testimony, if it were to be allowed to impeach Webster, only would have gone to the early 90s, which was not even the time of the charged conduct in this case.
So and the other testimony came from other cooperators? In other words, you say that Webster and...
Well, I think the strongest evidence that Webster and McDade knew each other was the wiretaps. The government strongly opposes appellant's counsel's statements. The wiretaps in this case were incredibly damaging evidence. They were powerful. There were calls on September 28th of 1999 when Mr. Singleton, the overarching supplier, was having issues with his suppliers. There were phone calls. First of all, there were calls between Webster and appellant in this case, multiple calls. Calls where Webster tells appellant, you're the center of the puzzle. I need you to get the information. In a different call, she says, can you check your lucky lottery tickets? When can you get to those? And Mr. McDade's answer is, as soon as I get off work. There are other calls where Webster's on the phone with Singleton, and she says, B, referring to appellant, she says, B is at work. He works as a trash truck driver. But as soon as he gets home, he's going to get us this information. And if you look at the calls, there were...
So defendant's point is, how do you translate those into incriminating statements?
Oh, well, the government would argue it's direct evidence indicating appellant's role as
I'm
the book...
I'm going to check my lottery tickets?
Well, there's evidence in this case. Webster's testimony is that appellant kept track of the quantities of drugs sold, the prices purchased and paid on the back of lottery tickets. That was his system. So
that was his bookkeeping, right?
That was exactly right, Your Honor. I guess he found that to be an adequate way to keep track and potentially be safer than making it obvious on paper. So the wiretaps, well, I'll just go back for a minute. With respect to what Judge Friedman found, the government thinks that his reasoning was right. Additionally, with respect to Robinson, just like Douglas and Flowers, it would have countered a defense strategy to put Robinson on the stand for this slight piece of collateral impeachment, which, by the way, of course, Webster had already been significantly impeached by the defense during her cross, especially given that there was so little that Robinson could add. And overall, this case was a compelling, powerful case proving appellant's role as a bookkeeper in this drug distribution.
In your brief, you say it was a strong case, which is distinct from the government's normal. This was an overwhelming case.
Well, I think No,
I'm serious. So there's this little leeway, even that the government acknowledges.
Well, it was compelling, Your Honor, in the sense that, in addition, let's say we took Robinson and Webster, let's say we took them off the table, forgetting the slight impeachment value if appellant had been allowed to get these witnesses, they'd been interviewed and they testified. Let's say we took them out of the trial altogether. We still had the clear testimony of James Miles and Benjamin Ash, both of whom testified quite clearly about appellant's role in the operation. They had purchased cocaine from appellant Miles on multiple occasions. Mr. Ash had, in fact, one time stopped his car, gotten out, and given appellant $40,000 in cash to give to Webster.
All right, but the argument is all of these were subject to impeachment.
That's true, Your Honor.
So the strong evidence
It's the collaboration. It's four people taking the stand, all being detailed about appellant's role. It's the wiretap evidence, which the government argues when you read the transcripts.
What I was about to say, if I could just finish my sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize.
That you had these cooperators all fingering the defendant, McDade, but you had evidence about this bookkeeping system plus the wiretaps. So that's some what I'll call objective third party independent evidence.
Yes, and on top of that, Your Honor, of course, is the testimony of appellant's boss from Waste Management and mm-hmm. from the FBI agent, who both testified about the day that they went to arrest appellant, how appellant basically fled. He wasn't even informed by his boss. His boss just said, come back to work. And the next thing they know, appellant he answers a phone call after avoiding his boss for a while, and he says, I'm gone. And the trash truck is found ditched with the keys in, the engine running behind a motel in Virginia. And when the FBI agent calls him later that day and says, there's a warrant out for your arrest, appellant hangs up the phone and remains a fugitive for 7 months. So it's all of this evidence cumulatively which proves that this case is compelling. And this case, I think the government argues, is much like the DeBongo case, where the court this court was troubled by a lawyer's failure to interview a potentially corroborating witness. But nonetheless, the court found that the government's case was compelling, and therefore the court could be comfortable in finding a reasonable probability that the jury's verdict would have been different. And I think that's exactly right. This is not a case where the cases that are cited in the briefing where courts find prejudice typically come in weaker cases where there really is a reasonable question as to whether or not the jury's verdict would be different if this one person was interviewed, if this one person had testified. This is not that case. If there are no further questions, the government submits on its briefing and the arguments made here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just quickly try to answer some of the questions you've asked. Flowers was convicted of a 924G offense, so inherently he had a gun charge. There was a 924C charge against Douglas, but it was dismissed in the case that he was sentenced in. The recordings, the wiretaps, do not identify who B was in any way as a trash truck driver. In fact, Webster conceded that she referred to two different people as B, Mr. McDade and Mr. Ash. So it is an open question who she was talking to at that point. And no lottery tickets were ever found. So this is totally coming from Ms. Webster. As for Ash, he never purchased drugs from Mr. McDade. He claimed that he called the phone number he was given. It was answered by a man named Black, who was not Mr. McDade, and Black provided the drugs. So and as for Miles, it's clear from his testimony that he was working through a guy named Bell, who was dead at the time of his trial, and that Bell was the main person who he claimed was negotiating drug transactions, and he was there peripherally. So the government's case was not nearly as strong as it would like you to believe.
The fleeing is a problem.
The fleeing is, but Mr. McDade also came back on his own voluntarily after 7 months. So, you know, he did flee, but that's a piece of evidence against him. And the trial counsel would have to deal with it. As for what the standard is, this court has never quite decided what the standard of review is going to be. It says in DeBango that other courts have used de novo review here in this situation, but it has never itself taken a position on it. And
you're talking about on the prejudice prong.
On the prejudice prong, yes. So I don't think that this is as clear as the government would like you to believe. And the appellate decision, I'm sorry, okay. I think those are the main points I want to make.
All right, thank you. Mr. Becker, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant, and we appreciate your assistance, and thank you.
Thank you very much.